You're listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 3800 Marlton Pike. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 p.m.
It's a funny little bit of irony that I'm talking to you all tonight. It's Father's Day. And I haven't really celebrated Father's Day since maybe 2004 or a little earlier, because that was the year that my brothers and I, we lost our dad. He took his own life. It was a hard time. And there's kind of nothing little or funny or ironic about that at all. But there's been some time. There's been a good while since then. So I have there's some comfort in trying to grab your attention by saying it's funny and little and ironic. So my cellmates and I were talking about this last week. Once we kind of knew that we'd be talking on Father's Day and we had to kind of come up with a speech together, you know, this obviously came to our mind, because I'm not the only one in my cell who's lost a parent or really never had a parent in one way or another. So it got us thinking about really one of the main ways that we relate to God, and Ben kind of brought this up earlier. We relate to God as our Father, right? And so we tried to ask, what does it mean to say that God is our Father? And we kind of we bumbled around a lot. We felt a lot uncomfortable. We weren't really sure what to say, how to follow that thread. And so we tried to make sense of our particular experience, and it was interesting. And someone suggested, hey, what if we kind of took that phrase, God is Father, and changed it up a little bit. And we took the Lord's Prayer and said, you know, our Dad who is in heaven. And that kind of that was a little more whoa. Yeah, that kind of unlocked some stuff, and it literally opened some eyes. There was somebody staring back going, wow. So it struck us as a little strange, and it got the ball rolling. And so for me, I started to ask the question, do I think about God like I think about my dad who's not alive? I don't relate to my dad like I do to my mom, right? She and I, like most humans in my life, we exchange words, we exchange presents, prayers, and time. We spend time together. With my dad, though, I'm holding on to something much more intangible. It's memories, it's projections, dreams. He shows up in my dreams all the time. Questions. And maybe God's a lot like that, right? Lurking in the places that aren't always front and center. I remember last summer we were watching, we were at my grandma's little lake cottage, and we found these old videotapes, and I was maybe five or six in them. The funniest part is that my mom was running a birthday party for me, and she was yelling at all my friends, and it was like, oh, yeah, I remember that. But one of the most shocking and disorienting parts was my dad was in these videos, and I hear his voice, and it was like, whoa, I haven't heard that voice in over 10 years. I forgot what it sounded like. So I turned to my mom and I was like, was that what he really sounded like? It's a little more nasal than I kind of remember it, you know? And so I kind of wonder, you know, that's kind of indicative of me, of kind of maybe my journey with God. It kind of feels like that. Like turning to somebody and asking, is that what he sounds like? Because we don't quite know, right? So suffice to say, God as a father figure is a touchy subject for me, right? It doesn't quite work. But I don't think I'm alone. I think the cultural imagery of father is tainted, to say the least, right? So let's take a few examples. The Berenstain Bears, right? The one criticism of them, the dad father, right? He's always angry and he's yelling, like in the book about the troubled report card. Take Bart Simpson, right? His dad. Not so great, not so loving, not so kind. I had to look up their names, but Brad and Randy and Mark, right? Their dad's always kind of a not the perfect dad, right? All of these fathers are the epitome of incompetence, right? You think about that. The paper towel commercials with the dad who's always making the messes, and the perfect mom actress has to come behind, and thanks to the paper towel, she can wipe away the sins of her incompetent father. Husband, father figure there. But to look somewhat higher for the bad dad image, we can kind of ascend the ladder of cultural snobbery and look at Shakespeare's King Lear, if you ever read that. His foolishness in giving away his entire kingdom leads to his daughter and ultimately his own death. You've got one of my favorites, Homer's Odysseus. The dude takes 10 years to get home from the Trojan War, and literally the day after he gets there, he's like, I gotta peace out, bye, I gotta go on this other journey. And of course, the most famous bad dad relationship, Oedipus and his father, right? That's not actually his father, that's the Sphinx, but that's the only way to identify Oedipus, because who knows what he looks like. So suffice to say, our cultural imagery of the father, both high and low, is full of this kind of like tension, like it's not clear, right? So yeah, I'm letting my English nerd flag fly high. Hold on tight. So what do we do with this metaphor of God as father? Jesus in the New Testament, like in the kind of Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, God's not really talked about as father. There's like some imagery in the Psalms and stuff like that, but it's not like, that's not the main metaphor, right? But in the New Testament, Jesus is like kind of latches right onto that. He uses the phrase Abba. In the Greek, it comes across as pater. He uses this some 165 times. St. Paul's pretty obsessed with it too. He uses it around 40 times. And it was such a popular image that the early Christians in Greece especially would like latched onto the actual word that Jesus used. They would say Abba when they were talking about God because it was this like new and strange thing. And that's part of it, right? Like thinking about God as a father is like a totally new concept to them. They're coming out of a world where like the ancient world where gods are powerful and distant and they throw lightning bolts down and they come down and they take your women and your cattle and all this stuff, and it's you know, it's new to them, right? The gods were not close like a daddy. But to us in 2017, God as father is kind of old hat, right? We've heard it a few times, plus we're hip to the patriarchy and all that. It doesn't strike us as strange to say that God is father. So this starts to get at a problem that I've been mildly, I would say, obsessed with for maybe the last 10 years or so. For simplicity's sake, let's call it the problem of language. It's an obsession that almost got me kicked out of Bible college. But thanks to my soon-to-be father-in-law, he convinced me that pretending to be a good Baptist was worth a diploma. It was probably true, in hindsight. This problem, language, not Bible college, was framed really well for me in a passage from an essay by the Southern novelist Walker Percy. The essay is called Why I'm a Catholic. He doesn't actually answer that question, but he does talk about what it means to be a Christian novelist, like what the job of someone who's a Christian and uses words professionally is. And he says, here, let me read it for you. So decrepit and so abused is the language of the Judeo-Christian religions that it takes an effort to salvage them, the very words, from the husks and barnacles of meaning which have encrusted them over the centuries. Or else words can become slick as coins, worn thin by usage and so devalued. One of the tasks of the saint is to renew language, to sing a new song. Language, imagery, words, they can get stale, right? They can lose their meaning. We, or at least the saints, as Percy would suggest, can go back to the well. We can try and renew that. A simple story about this kind of slipperiness or devaluation happened for me in college. And I told this story to myself, so I'll include their reaction, which undercuts it a little, but that's fine. So I went to Bible college, so that meant I ran into language about God and the Christian religion a lot, right? And one of these was that I got really, really sick of one of the ways that my classmates would talk about God. They would talk about, you know, my relationship with the Lord. And, it, you know, there's this kind of like intonation to it, this kind of like, I don't know. It like rings in a certain way in my head. And so, you know, it felt like a little bit of code maybe for the like, I've got this like special close relationship thing with the Lord. And so I hated that. So I rebelled and I was like, I'm going to call him God, you know, and I like even that like haughty little intonation of God, you know, like that, I, you know, that was, that captured for me how I was seeing God at that point. So when we were talking about this in my cell though, they were like, nah, like Lord was fine for me. You know, they were like, good Lord, you know, like that, like it kind of had this kind of lightness to it. You know, it didn't have to be this kind of like in out sort of thing. Or even like James Comey, right, in his testimony was like, Lordy, I hope there's tapes, you know, that sort of thing. It's fine. But even for me, like later on in life, I was listening to some talk by N.T. Wright or something, and he talked about how Lord was like this really specific term that the writers in the New Testament use to be politically subversive and talk about Jesus and kind of compare him with Caesar and stuff like that. And I was like, ooh, okay, maybe I can kind of get back into this term a little bit, you know, with some of that subtle nuance of meaning. So maybe we can sing the new song that Walker Percy talks about, you know. But it also might not be that simple. So I want to say it's not quite that simple because I think there's maybe a deeper problem with language. It's got its limits. There's only so far that we can actually go. There's only so far that words can take us. If poets like Wallace Stevens here are correct, then we're all just reusing someone else's images and ideas. In his poem called The Man on the Dump, he reminds us that the dump is full of images. And what he means is that everything we think we so originally say has more or less already been said, right? In particular, he pokes fun at how people in his time would compare everything to a dewdrop, you know, a dress, a necklace, a face, all of it was dewy. And so, you know, he's kind of poking at that. But later in the poem, he marvels, his speaker in the poem marvels at the moon rising from the dump, shed of all its images. It's just the moon. And he says, and you see as a man, you see the moon rise in the empty sky. It's just the moon. It's not a glowing orb. It's not a vanilla wafer in the sky. It's just the moon. Can you see it? Just the moon? So I swear I'm not just quoting poems because I want to, or I'm trying to make a point to Lauren that going to graduate school in English was actually worth it. I think that Stevens is actually pointing to something here. A lot of the way that we talk, and especially about things like God and our deepest selves, is rife with this borrowed surface-level imagery. Think about the last time you tried to talk to somebody who had just lost someone very close to them. Or maybe you try to talk to a friend who's in the deep throes of depression. And you get to the point where the words just kind of like fall flat, and it just feels like it's not working. This is my friend Kate from college. And Kate lost her mom maybe a year after I lost my dad. And so we had this little moment where she was talking about how she just wanted people to stop talking to her about it because like everything that everybody said just kind of it didn't really stick or it felt like it didn't matter in that moment. And I nodded back at her and we shared this little moment of kind of deep understanding and shared experience. You know, we looked at each other and we like saw each other like Stevens's man seeing the moon, right? It was just like you saw it. Yeah, we couldn't quite make sense of it, but we did see it. And I think our experience of God is something more like that. It's more like just seeing. One of my favorite moments from many of the books I've read is at the end of Dante's journey through hell and purgatory and heaven. He gets to the highest point in heaven, the highest circle there, and he stares. Well, technically he doesn't stare. He actually looks at the reflection in Beatrice's eyes, looking back, because he can't actually look at God. But what he sees is the infinite circle of God's love, and this is Gustave Doré's rendering of that. And he looks, and even though he's been writing a poem for three whole steps through the entire universe, he can't say a thing. He's just he's at a loss. So what's the too long didn't read version of what I'm saying here? It's something like this. As humans, our shared use of language fails to really capture our experience of God. To say that God is our Father is one thing. To experience that is beyond what words can actually do for us. It happens in a place that someone in my cell very beautifully called the tension of being. It's that place below the surface, that place beyond words. That's where we interact with God. But so what? does the problem that I'm talking about here really affect how we follow Jesus? If language is such a problem, are we stuck, like the postmodern theorists and their disciples want us to believe, that we're just kind of stuck in our own heads? Maybe. Maybe we are. But I want to suggest that that actually might not matter. That we can choose to trust in the mystery that Jesus calls us into, and that might get us through it. So, to be grossly reductive, I think what Jesus is calling us into is something like this, and he describes it in a bunch of different ways, but it could be boiled down to this. Have a relationship with God that is defined by love. And two, have a relationship with everybody else that's also defined by love. The one passage I love is where he quotes from the prophets. And he says, he has shown you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you. There's that Lord again. Lord requires of you. Do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. So let's tackle these kind of one at a time. Let's take, if you will, and kind of consider them in light of the problem we've been talking about and what we might glean from that. I think a lot of the time I get very frustrated about trying to understand what it means to love God. I do things like sing songs or say or intend or mean some kind of like prayer-like thing. And I cultivate some small practices or something like that. And I keep doing this even though there's this really murky feedback loop on that, right? I'm not getting the reaction per se. But I think even in that, I'm still thinking about loving God like I would think about loving another person. I'm working from my experiences of loving people, and I'm kind of cobbling together some tools and images of how to relate to God. For instance, I sing songs to people to express my emotions. I wrote some really bad songs in high school to girls, right? That was something I did. I make prayer-like gestures at people all the time. Would you please? I build small practices to keep my relationships healthy, right? So I'm trying to say that my relationship with God is actually built on images from human experiences, when it's probably something more like Stevens's man staring at the moon, right? Like it's something other. Now, I don't want to fully suggest that we quit all of the wonderful practices that you may have cultivated to kind of stir up this love for God in yourself. But I do want to say that maybe there's some time for clearing the shelf off of all our preconceived ideas and images and just staring. And for me, loving God's, a deeply underdeveloped part of my spiritual practice. And so one of the questions I want you to start thinking about for Talk Back is, when you think about loving God, how do you frame that for yourself in relating to God in love? So put a pin in that in your mind. Start thinking about that. But also people, right? The other thing Jesus calls us into is loving people. He says to love your neighbor as yourself. So what does this little predicament of language uncover for us about loving the other? To start off with, it's hard, right? Language makes it harder for us. We talked about language having its limitations. And one of, to kind of go back to the God as Father image, it points out another hard thing about language. It's paradoxically communal. It's shared. It's something we all have in common. But it's also something wildly personal. Let's take the Father image. When I say father or dad or daddy, we all kind of have a general sense of what I'm getting at, right? A dad is someone who may or may not have had a hand in your creation. He's someone who, at least in our culture, is someone who cares for you in the early years of your life and has your well-being in mind. That's the general sense of it. But that general sense can get kind of twisted or charged with specific meaning through things like loss or trauma or profound experience of one kind or another. We all have our personal fathers, and so we all have our shades of understanding what God as Father might mean. And I think this kind of realization is important for us when we think about loving people, because it's easy to get stuck in our own shades of meaning. We take the moral high ground. We cling to our more nuanced ways of seeing a thing. You know, we understand something better than someone else. One way that I really like describing this is a passage from the novelist Philip Roth. And he writes in his book, American Pastoral, that getting people wrong is really what being human's all about. This isn't the whole novel, I promise, but just a piece of it. This is coming in a context where the narrator is telling the reader about a character he's just met, and then he's going to go on for the rest of the book to make up a story about this person, which is totally untrue. So it's a frame within a frame. So he says, you fight your superficiality, your shallowness, so as to try to come at people without unreal expectations, without an overload of bias or hope or arrogance, as untank-like as you can be, sans cannon and machine guns and steel plating half a foot thick. You come at them unmenacingly on your own 10 toes instead of tearing up the turf with your caterpillar treads. Take them on with an open mind, as equals, man to man, as we used to say. And yet you never fail to get them wrong. You might as well have the brain of a tank. You get them wrong before you meet them, while you're anticipating meeting them. You get them wrong while you're with them. And then you go home to tell someone else about the meeting, and you get them all wrong again. Since the same generally goes for them with you, this whole thing is really a dazzling illusion. The fact remains that getting people right is not what living is all about anyway. It's about getting them wrong that's living. Getting them wrong and wrong and wrong, and then on careful reconsideration, getting them wrong again. That's how we know we're alive. We're wrong. For Roth, just acknowledging your wrongness is really enough. That's his worldview. But I think it's actually possible to do something a little bit more. I think we can recognize that wrongness and still attempt to follow Jesus' commands to love. This is how we lean into the mystery. And to do so, I think we'll also need to try to get outside our own shades of meaning, our own inherent wrongness. And I want to suggest a few ways of doing that. Number one, choose questions over declarations. There's this wonderful little part in Alice in Wonderland, which if you've seen the movie, you'll probably remember. Alice down in the Wonderland, she takes all these potions which actually change her physical appearance, and one of them gives her this gigantic neck. She takes this potion, and all of a sudden her head goes shooting up through a tree, and it disturbs a pigeon's nest. And the mother pigeon starts freaking out at Alice, of course, and she says, "You're a snake!" And Alice is like, "I'm a little girl, what are you talking about?" But for the pigeon, and the pigeon goes on to clarify, you know, Alice has a long neck. Snakes have long necks. Snakes try and eat the eggs out of her nest. And this appears to be what Alice is doing. She's disturbing the nest. So Alice struggles to fight back against the pigeon's claims because she's in the Wonderland and everything is strange. She gets pigeonholed by the pigeon. I think Alice's story shows us something about making declarative statements, right? The pigeon says, "You are a snake." And Alice has to say, "Am I a snake or am I not a snake?" She has to deal with that statement of fact. That's the hard thing about declarations, right? They box people in. It makes them agree or disagree with that proposition. And if it's about them, that can feel like a judgment of themselves as well. So there's a lot to unpack there. Conversely, questions invite the opportunity to create shared meaning, or at least the opportunity to examine two propositions side by side, right? Questions are about participation. Declarations are about judgment. Secondly, I want to suggest that you should choose stories over definitions. This whole talk could have been much simpler and boiled down to just this, to talk about how Jesus tells stories to get things across, right? He didn't just come with a bullet list and a dictionary and say, "Here it is, folks, take it and go. The kingdom of heaven is like," and, you know, "a mustard seed," or "this woman who loses a coin." But the point, kind of back to what the story Ben was alluding to earlier with the prodigal son, this rich son takes his inheritance, right? And the point here is that Jesus is showing us what a father is in this story. The son takes his inheritance. He squanders it like a baller. Then he gets poor, becomes a beggar, and comes back home. And his father's like, "Great, let's have a feast," which doesn't seem logical, right? That's the kind of father that Jesus is thinking about when he says, "Abba." Definitions are concise. They're reductive. They leave a lot of things out. Stories, on the other hand, help us to unpack things. And also, stories are one of the prime ways that we get to vicariously live through someone else's experience. One of my favorite teachers once said that reading or hearing stories is like getting to watch bombs go off before they go off in your life, so you know what it looks like. We need to tell more stories. The third and final little thing we can do to get outside our own shades of meaning is to choose self-descriptions over others' descriptions. It's kind of going back to that declarations thing. This really could just be a plug for the only book from the psychology self-help section I'm ever going to recommend to anybody, Nonviolent Communication by Marshall Rosenbaum, something like that. The whole book could be summed up with something like this. Learn to couch your language in objective statements of your own feelings in order to invite the other into an opportunity to respond out of grace. One of the problems of human experience, and I think this book really does a good job of bridging this gap, is that what the postmodern thinkers base a lot of their positions on is actually kind of true. It's very difficult to bridge the gap between your experience, like my experience with your experience. We're stuck in our own heads a little bit. But like Roth said, we get each other wrong. So, starting conversations with what you do know, which is your experience, your feelings, your universe, and inviting somebody else into that opens the door to mutual healing and to love.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.